You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lillian Henley tōku ingoa nō mai haere mai ki te Wire mo tēnei rā, te rā rua kaumātahi o pautū te rangi. Hello and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 21st of March. My name is Lillian Henley. I'm joined in studio by Alan Blackman. Sorry, let's chuck you on there. How are you?
I'm very well, how are you?
And joined in studio by James.
Hi.
How are you, James?
Good, thanks.
James is with us today. He's a Gateway student from Auckland Grammar School. How have you found the day?
I found it great, thanks.
Just heard you on the news there, which is exciting.
Yeah.
Very cool. All right, coming up on the show today, Dear Science, we are talking about Stephen Hawking, platypus milk and unlearning. Still also have no Tracy Martin, but we're working on getting a regular slot with her where we speak to her at the same time every week, which will be good. We have a story about Ngā Tapuwai, a school out south where they've composed a haka. It was the end of last year, but I came across it recently, the haka that went viral on the internet about the way the students felt about the misrepresentation of South Auckland, and I spoke with the person who composed it. It's Wire Worry Week, and we're looking into how the government wants us to be smoke-free by 2025. Lisa Baudet has looked into anti-smoking campaigns and whether they're efficient, and Leah Garcia-Purvis is looking at the cost of quitting. So we'll hear a bit about that later. If you want to get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, Wai Mai Rane, text us on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. But now it's time for...
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, it is. All right. Hey,
good,
Alan.
Good afternoon, Lillian.
We are speaking first on Stephen Hawking, the late Stephen Hawking, who passed away at 76 last week.
He did indeed, and it was sort of immediately after the show last week, I guess, got back and found that this was all over the news. Yeah, so very sad. So I guess, you know, we can just talk a little bit about him and what he did and stuff like that.
Definitely.
So as you said, he was 76, born in 1942. He did all the sort of quote-unquote normal things that academics tend to do. So he went through Oxford. He did his undergraduate at Oxford. And he just apparently scraped through with a first at Oxford.
A university?
Yes, indeed. Yes, he just scraped through. And apparently what he had to do was to have an oral exam because he was sort of on the cusp between a first and a second. And so they asked him, or they kind of didn't like him because they thought he was a bit of a smart ass and stuff like that. And so they said, well...
They thought he was a smart ass.
Yeah.
Like in a bit of a sarcastic way.
Yeah. He certainly had a sense of humour, by all accounts anyway. But when he got asked that question, they said, you know, what... what are you going to do? And he said, well, if you give me a first, I'll go to Cambridge, and if you give me a second, I'll stay at Oxford. And so they gave him a first.
Really?
Apparently, so the story goes. Yes, yeah.
So it was a bit of a fuck you, I'm off.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. Yeah, I don't think he enjoyed his time there. And then he went to Cambridge and he started his PhD, and he really wanted to work with this guy by the name of Fred Hoyle, who was sort of big in physics in those days, who was going on about the Big Bang and stuff like that. But he wasn't able to work with him, which is probably a blessing in disguise. And so he started working out with another guy who was a cosmologist. And sort of a year or two into his PhD, he got diagnosed with motor neurone disease, as everybody knows. And so he was given 2 years to live at that stage.
What?
And he thought, you know, what's the point in keeping on going studying a PhD? I probably won't live to see it. But he did, and he kept going, and he got a fantastic PhD out of that. And then after that, he stayed on as a researcher at Cambridge for a while. Then he went to Caltech, which is the California Institute of Technology, which is the place to be in the USA. And he was there for a few years, and then he eventually returned sort of mid-70s to Cambridge to a full-time position, where he was the Lucasian Professor of Maths.
Whoa.
and he was the 17th Lacassian professor of maths. The second Lacassian professor of maths was one Isaac Newton.
Whoa.
Yeah, yeah. So they don't give those out, you know, to any old people.
Where does the name come from, can I ask?
I have no idea. Okay. I really should have looked that up. Probably somebody by the name of Lucas, I guess.
Okay.
Who was probably the first Lacassian professor of math, I would guess anyway. But so it was about 300 years between him and Newton, obviously.
Right.
And so what did he do, I guess?
At this point, was he, in terms of his disease, was that deteriorating or?
Yes, it was. Yeah. And apparently the most difficult thing for him to do was to speak, by all accounts. He really sort of lost the power of speech quite early, and it was very, very difficult to understand. But it wasn't until apparently about 1985 where he had a collapse or something in Switzerland, and they had to do an emergency tracheotomy, and he lost his voice as a result of that tracheotomy. And so that's where he ended up getting that terrible-sounding digital voice synthesizer that we all know him from, with the grating American accent. And despite all the sort of improvements in technology and everything, he just stuck with that for his whole life because I guess he figured that was his voice
now,
at the time,
yeah.
and everybody knew, you know, what his voice was. So why is he so well known? Well, obviously the disease had a lot to do with that because, you know, there's a hell of a lot of physicists out there who've achieved just as much, if not more, than him, and nobody knows their names. So, you know... The fact that
that's interesting that you say that. Because everybody does know Stephen Hawking.
Yeah,
I have no sort of knowledge actually of what really the sort of stuff that he studied or the stuff that he does.
Exactly, yes. Yep.
But we know that he was this incredible person.
Yes, yep. No, and you know, an undoubtedly incredible intellect whose body sadly, you know, failed him at an early age of life. And so, you know, this enormous intellect trapped in a useless body, unfortunately. And, you know, life must have been very, very tough for him, but by all accounts, he was, you know, fairly upbeat about things. I guess if you're told you've got 2 years to live and you live for another 50-odd, then, you know, even though it's probably not the best way of life, but, you know, it was he was extremely lucky to live as long as he did, I guess. Mm. So his
But I guess, too, that's them for them to decide whether if they, you know, in terms of the quality of life, mm-hmm. It's up to him.
Absolutely, yes. Yep, and I totally agree with that, yeah. So the work that he did, the work that he was really famous for was very early on in his career, as is the case with a lot of academics. If they're going to be sort of world beaters, they do their best work sort of straight out of their PhD, just after their postdoc, whatever. And he was made a fellow of the Royal Society at the age of 32, which is just ridiculous. You know, people work their lives to become fellows of the Royal Society. It's the highest sort of academic honour you can get in Britain, and to get it at age 32 is just crazy. So they obviously recognised that he was, you know, a very, very special talent, even at that very, very early age. And his work, as I said, that he was famous for was work on black holes. So
I did know that, actually.
There we go. So, yeah, yep. And he really made his name on that, and really sort of the geometry of black holes, the fact that they have to be spherical, this thing called the event horizon where nothing can get out of the black hole. So that's sort of the surface of the black hole, as it were. And he, in collaboration with a guy by the name of Roger Penrose, who was a mathematician, did a lot of work on really sort of the mathematics and the thermodynamics and the quantum mechanics of black holes, and kind of made them a little bit more sort of understandable to the layperson, I guess. And some of the work that he did was following on, in fact, from a little-known New Zealand scientist who should be better known by the name of Roy Kerr. He was a mathematician, and he sort of solved all the equations for black holes and stuff before Hawking started his work. So hopefully he sort of gets a little bit of a mention in all of Hawking's obituaries, because you know, he's a fine scientist. He's still alive. He did his PhD down at Canterbury, and I think he was a staff member there. But you know, really remarkable stuff. So, basically, I think the reason that Hawking is so well known is because he wrote a book called A Brief History of Time, and that sold 25 million copies all around the world. And it's probably a book that's more purchased than read, maybe. I think there's probably a lot of copies sitting on bookshelves around the world that haven't been opened.
Right.
Maybe.
Why do you say that?
Oh, well, it's, you know, it's tough stuff.
Yeah,
you
right, know, okay.
Conceptually, it's very, very difficult stuff to get
people,
your head around.
People buying it because it's Stephen Hawking's book
might read the first few pages and think, oh. But, you know, that's what science needs is more publicists and people who are going to write for the general public and be able to put things in words that everybody can understand, because science is, you know, very, very important to humanity.
It's funny you say that. I think, from memory, I was at school at Auckland Girls Grammar, and we had a visit from his daughter.
Oh, wow.
Who came and spoke, because she wrote a book, but it was a fiction book about space.
Okay, yes. Yep.
And they may have the details incorrect, but obviously her science in that book would have been informed by quite...
By a good mind, yes.
Accurate information. So, you know, something, I mean, that's quite something, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. Obviously, when he got invited to speak at conferences and stuff like that, he had to have a whole entourage of sort of people looking after him and everything. So it was horribly expensive to get to anywhere. And he had to fly by private jet because, you know, they couldn't get him on a normal plane and stuff like that. And all of the venues had to be wheelchair friendly, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, it was quite a mission, I guess, to get him to appear at places. It was difficult for him. But, you know, he was working up until the day he died, sort of, you know, a couple of weeks before he submitted his final paper and everything. So he was still working. And he is probably the only person to both have appeared on The Simpsons and done lyrics on two Pink Floyd songs.
Very good reference there. That's quite the achievement, though.
Yeah, I reckon.
To appear on Simpsons, I think, too, and Pink Floyd.
Yeah, no, when you're on The Simpsons, cool. You've made it, you know.
Yeah.
But so now that he's gone, who's going to take his place? And the obvious one is probably Brian Cox. No?
Sorry.
Right, there we go.
Oh, wait, yes. Okay, James has heard of him. Who is this person?
I have no idea. I've just heard the name.
Okay.
So he's a publiciser of physics as well, and his big claim to fame was that he was in a band called D-Ream, who had a hit, Things Can Only Get Better, sort of late in the 80s, and then he decided that the music industry wasn't for him and he became a professor of physics.
Oh, okay.
So that's
a
nice little career path, that one. Yeah. He's very listenable too. He can put things in sort of nice, easy language. So
yeah, important that.
So R.I.P. Stephen Hawking.
There you go. That is quite a nice little kōrero, though. Thank you, Alan. All right. Well, we'll move on and talk about platypus milk.
Indeed.
What about this? Milk.
It's funny what catches your eye when you're sort of scanning the online newspapers and stuff like that. And this one just, you know, platypus milk could help cure disease and stuff like that. So obviously I had to read that. And
tell us more.
So there's some researchers in Australia, funnily enough, who've been studying platypus milk. And they found about sort of 7 or 8 years ago that it had really, really good antibacterial properties. It wouldn't touch all the good bacteria in your gut, but all of these nasty bacteria, it would, you know, act as a really good antibacterial agent.
That's amazing.
And so what they've done now is they've traced that antibacterial activity to a protein that's found in the milk. And even more interesting, the protein has got a weird fold. Okay, proteins.
Yeah, what?
Folded? Okay, precisely, exactly. Right, so proteins are big, 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 big long molecules. Okay, they're just a big, like, you know, piece of string, basically. And when they're in our bods and our cells and all that sort of stuff, then they fold up in absolutely particular ways. And there's only two ways, really, that they fold. They fold into a thing called an alpha helix or a beta sheet. Okay, and those
James is nodding. Okay, we know.
So that's good. So that's really the only two ways that proteins are known to fold. But now they found this protein in platypus milk that's got this totally unprecedented method of folding, and so they're figuring maybe the antibacterial activity is linked to that, and so maybe if they can replicate that in perhaps other molecules, other protein molecules that they could make, then they might also exhibit these really good potent antibacterial properties, and they might maybe sort of be a replacement for antibiotics or something like that. Okay, so...
Whoa.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is all pie-in-the-sky stuff at the moment.
And also they'd have to, like, farm or harvest platypus.
Well, not necessarily... Well, platypus milk. Okay, then so the platypus is a protected species over in Oz, so they can't sort of touch them or anything like that. So, but, you know, they can obviously get the milk and stuff.
How?
Well,
in captivity.
Well, apparently, okay, so here's something I didn't know. So you do know that platypuses?
Yes,
I don't. What do we call them?
I don't know. Yeah. English is my second language, so.
platypuses, let's say. So they don't have teats. And so somehow when they're feeding the young, they actually express their milk onto their tummies and then
what?
The little ones lick it up, apparently.
Wow.
Now, because they don't have teats, that's not a sterile delivery system. Okay?
Because it goes so, onto there.
Because it's onto there. So that's why people think that maybe, possibly, they've got this antibacterial thing in them to sort of keep all the nasty bacteria away while they're doing this. Okay? So that's a theory. It seems reasonable to me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, yeah. But so antibiotic a replacement for antibiotics through platypus milk, possibly. Who knows? But it's really nice. I mean, the really nice bit in this is the whole new folding of the protein, and that's
right.
A big discovery. And there's over 100,000 proteins that have been structurally characterized. We know how they fold, and this is the first one of those 100,000 that's got this particular fold in it. So that's quite big news.
Yeah.
So yeah, if you're a biologist or yeah,
right. Still not sold on the just going and taking the milk from.
Well, you know, all in the name of science.
Okay. Okay. All right. And our last story, is not really science, but there is an advertising campaign from the University of Sydney to unlearn.
Yes,
that's the concept.
I encourage you all to visit the University of Sydney website. Now, the University of Sydney is ranked, I'm pretty sure, number one university in Australia. It's either that or the University of Melbourne, but they're certainly those are the top two. Very, very good universities, both in the top 50 in the world. And so the University of Sydney has seen it necessary to put out a new advertising slogan. And this slogan is Unlearn. And if I may, I'm going to read you what it says on their website.
Absolutely.
Okay, they start off by saying, learning is easy. Okay, now, you know, that's just not a very nice thing to say to start off with. Learning is easy, unlearning not so much. It takes bravery to be an unlearner, to be uncomfortable, unpopular, even unliked, to question the established and challenge the accepted, to unlearn truth. How the hell do you do that? Unlearn medicine, unlearn love. While learners become experts on the world, unlearners see it for what it could be. Imagine what would be possible if we all learn to unlearn. We've reimagined the way we teach so our students can reimagine the world.
Okay.
Okay, you said you were going to play devil's advocate.
Well, I'll let you go first.
No, where you go.
What is your issue with this?
What more is there to say?
I mean, are you worried that people are going to dismiss truth?
Yeah, well, how do you unlearn truth?
But, okay, so this is where I know. But if you're coming from a discipline of science, right, where truth is truth, right, you test something to the point where you cannot.
Here we go. This is going to be an art-science debate, isn't it? Here we go. I can see this coming.
You cannot dispute
the matter. School dear science, not dear arts.
Very good point. But you brought the topic into science.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Right.
Here we go.
So when you look at, in an arts discipline, you look at things that are constructed, right? And they are social constructs. So when something is considered the truth.
Yes.
It can be disputed.
But is there any such thing as the truth then in that case? Is it
there
the
you
truth?
Go.
If it can be disputed, is it truth?
Okay, that's a point, right?
Yep.
This is
yep.
what I'm saying, that if they are coming from the lens of looking at the world as this one type of norm or common sense way of being,
yes. yep.
that is something that we should unlearn, right?
Okay, so, okay, right, this all comes out of, I think, anyway, so 2 points. So first, the fact that universities have to advertise, what a waste of bloody money for starters.
Okay.
It really is, true. And number two, this whole thing, we have it drummed into us that we have to teach critical thinking.
Yes.
Okay, critical thinking. Oh, it's also important, critical thinking. Critical thinking doesn't mean to question absolutely everything and say that it's bullshit. You know, and I think that's the lesson that the students get a lot of the time. I think, you know, critical thinking, you've got to question everything. No, you don't question the truth, you know. You might question maybe how we arrive at the truth. And I always tell my students to, you know, I stand up here at the front of the class and I tell you all of these things and you should be saying, well, how?
How
do you know that, you know? And, but, unlearn. I mean, what a ridiculous slogan for a university, you know. I'm certain that this will be absolutely pilloried and they'll get rid of it in a month or
two. Do you
two
think so?
I think so. I think because, so. Because so they're going to be a bloody laughing stock.
But see,
stock.
This is how, like, if you're coming to this, right, so, for example, this is obviously my knowledge base and this is what I know, being raised in Te Ao Māori, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at something, so in that sense, my knowledge is learning that it's not good to sit on a table or it's...
There's
truth to that, right? Yes. And then another way of looking at it, it's not true that it's bad to sit on a table.
Yep.
So in unlearning the fact that there are different world views... And or sorry, unlearning the fact that there is only one worldview and relearning that there are other ways of seeing things.
What's wrong with just learning those without...
Without having to unlearn...
The worst thing of all, the word unlearn is in the Cambridge Dictionary, for God's sake.
Okay, so your issue is simply with the fact that people are advocating to unlearn as opposed to learning more.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
I can probably agree with you on that.
I'm absolutely gobsmacked, honestly. I think it's appalling. And yeah, indeed, the fact that universities have to advertise at all, I think, is just appalling. That we're trying to attract students, you know, because we're all funded on the number of bums on seats, et cetera, et cetera. It shouldn't be like that. You should go to a university because they give you a decent damn education, you know.
And there is a thirst for knowledge, a thirst for learning.
Amen, yes. Yeah. And it's not necessarily just a meal ticket to a job and all that. But,
yeah.
I mean, that you know, the boat's gone, the bus has left the station or whatever, you know, bloody phrases.
Well, we're moving into the neoliberal critiques of... The university of academia, you know?
Wow.
Or critiquing neoliberalism anyway.
Indeed. Critical thinking. Even,
that's right.
If you would.
Critical thinking. Well, very good. I think you're questioning what they're putting out there, so being very critical. Anyway, thank you, Alan.
My pleasure.
Coming on the show today.
Always fun.
We'll see you next week.
Okay, see ya.
That was Dear Science.
Swanfest, Saturday, March 24th at the Wine Cellar. For Addison David Whitley, forever and always rings true. With Charlie, OPI, Carols, Green Fog, PHF and Flameboy. Swanfest, this Saturday at the Wine Cellar, $10 on the door. All proceeds to the New Zealand Music Foundation Wellbeing Service. 0508 Music Help. Stay gold. It's music. Originator, broadcast to the world and podcast to your device on 95bfm.com.
Oh, we're back. I was supposed to play a sting. Anyway, we're here. All right, we'll play the sting.
I got a bit of a serve yesterday on the text messengers for being so politically biased and you know, going on about it all the time. But I mean, have you been alive for the last 9 years? Exactly.
The Wire.
Just need to remind everyone that you're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Now, a haka by the school Ngā Tapuwai went viral on Facebook at the end of last year, and I came across it recently. The meaning behind it and the lyrics were a challenge from the students about the way South Auckland is portrayed in popular discourse and in the media. Haumuera Kōtuku Maika works at Te Kura Māori o Ngā Tapuwai, the high school in Māngere East.
Kia ora tātou, ko Haumuera Kōtuku Maika tōku ingoa, he uri au no ngā waka o Horauta, Te Arawa, no Ngāti Porou tōku māma, no Te Arawa Tūhaurangi tōku pāpa. He kai ako reo Māori āhau i te kura Māori o ngā tapuai. Ko ai tētahi o ngā kai ako o te rōpū kapahaka o te kapa o ngā tapuai hoki. Kia ora.
Tēnā koe. It was suggested to Hamweta by some of the students to write on this issue, and together they composed the haka. Some of the lyrics translated to English say, "The vile, unrelenting talk they spout hinders the perception of where we are from. We are being advertised with slander. The media paints a distorted view. Māori as a people will not be divided." I spoke with Hamweta to find out more.
Ngā Tōpū Ai was started, I think when the Ngā Tōpū Ai College was like around 1975. I don't want to talk too much dates because I might get a few of them wrong, but the inception of the ASB festival, that's where Ngā Tōpū Ai entered, and they were like one of the mainstays or one of the original schools that started the Polynesian festival off. So it started off as a Polynesian festival, and then ASB sort of came in later on and supported it. So Ngā Tōpū Ai has been around for the group itself has been around since the opening of the kura. So yeah, it's been around for quite a few years there. And at that time, I think in the 70s, there was high gang activity. A lot of people have, a lot of parents had lost their jobs from freezing works, etc. So, Māori had experienced quite a decline in their wealth. So the kura was seen as like a pathway for their children to be re-immersed within the culture. And there's different kōrero around the social and political climate at that time. So Ngā Tōpū Ai emerged out of that during the sort of renaissance of the reo Māori, and it's those sorts of kaupapa that are similar to kura kaupapa. And the emergence at that time around the 80s. So that's where our group come from. It sort of grew out of that. And those sorts of themes are still carried on to this day, but obviously they've morphed. So, yeah.
In terms of that social political climate, there's similar issues that people are facing today. Do you think that kapaka, not only at Ngā Tōpū Ai but at other schools, is kapaka a way of raising those issues and challenging them?
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely that. That's what I see it as, because the origination of haka itself is very political in its nature. So even pre-European times, they would haka about different issues pertaining to different iwi and I suppose contested nature of certain issues. So that's the nature of haka, and we carry that on. And it's definitely a vehicle to put it across. However, I did see that it was the haka was shared on Facebook, and generally, you write a haka with the intention of it joining me hono atu ki ngā kaihaka, or so it's the kaihaka embrace it. And generally those topics and issues are ones that are very close to their hearts. So that's why I wrote the haka with that frame of mind, and because it was political, but I never really expected it to go outside of our competitions and go past the ears of those people that were either present or may have watched it. I didn't really expect that.
What, can you tell us a bit more about the haka itself? What's it called and what is it about? Where did the idea come from?
The haka is called Tāmaki ki te tonga mōrikarika. So it's like the South Auckland stereotypes. It's actually sort of like the close translation is like the South Auckland like thugs or dreads. And it's purposely called that because it's a play on what's being portrayed and how we actually experience it on the ground level. So it originated through my interest through like stereotypes and media and how those influence our people here at the ground level. So a lot of people just, you know, they might say, you know, it's just up to the individual. You know, that you have the power to change. Like, and I totally agree with that. But there are some influences that obviously shape how people think and act. And the origination of the origination sort of came about with a couple of my personal experiences being Māori and from South Auckland. So there's almost, how would you say it, it's double stereotype there. Just a few, from a few experiences from our students themselves. So when I sat down, I asked a few of our boys what we would like to write about, and then that's, a lot of them came up with it. Because just recently, before I wrote the haka, one of the boys, and they showed it on Te Karere, I think it was, and he went to Kathmandu, and there was him and his friend, and they were hit up quite a few times, and then they rang the police to come and escort them out of the shop, and their mother was there. And the boy that I'm talking about is is really well behaved, and he was just cut up about it. So was his mother, and I suppose you could interpret that in many ways, but a lot of that is around how people perceive not just South Aucklanders, but Māori in general and Pacific Islanders in general from South Auckland. It also came off the bat of a comment from John Banks, who sort of said, like, I was somewhere around the lines of, if we keep on giving these young male Māori Polynesians the dole, then they're going to be sitting down to plan their next robbery, and they're going to come through our windows at Epsom, and that's, these are being made by political figures, and generally that was what the haka emerged out of.
It's incredibly powerful, and it's incredibly moving hearing it from students, it from those young people that are affected.
Yeah, and that was because when it comes from them, and because it's also, I relate to it because I went to school here too, it's so easy for them to just fully connect to it, and that's the passion, and that's the wairua in which I had envisaged them doing it with when we first composed it. So we sat down and we composed the first verse, and then I sort of took over from the second. The first couple of weeks was all just about getting all of them to understand, fully the connection to their, to them every day. So last year I composed, with the help of some of the students, a haka around the murder of one of the girls, one of our ex-students that used to be at our kura. And part of it, not the whole lot of it, but part of it was because of the manifestation, so to speak, of these stereotypes, and that gangster sort of mentality, and don't get me wrong, it's the person's fault, like, he done it, but this boy was Māori. Actually it was put out as publicized, chosen Koroheke was her name, so she was an ex-student here, and it was that was sort of the follow-on from that haka, because he was almost the true manifestation of a lot of those stereotypes, and learning through their whānau and some of his whānau members, that yeah, that's where the haka that we done last year it originated from that. So and that was very close to the hearts of a lot of our students too, because a few of them you know, were her relations, and a lot of them knew her. So yeah.
Do you think that haka more generally should be, I mean, it is a place of discussion and debate and challenges. How do we put that on a more normalised level for wider New Zealand? Or do you think it shouldn't be?
I suppose that would have to come about by more people understanding it and having a willingness to know, you know, in more depth, and, you know, not just seeing it on the surface level as something that the All Blacks do. And, you know, just learning, like getting in and talking to people that actually do it, because they'll actually find that, you know, there's a lot to be taken from it, and a lot of expression, and a lot of, you know, because I've had conversations with Pākehā about it, about the nature of haka and how it's aggressive and violent, and that sort of speak is not true, because in a lot of different forms of haka, you know, we celebrate, you know, people's lives. We celebrate different occasions, you know, and as you would know, you know, being growing up and being immersed in that world, that's how it is. Yes, there's elements of aggression.
I also thought that there was an element of, like, flirtation.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It can be quite cheeky.
Yeah, so there's definitely that side of it too, because there's heaps of different forms. So where I'm from, you know, down the coast as well, from Ngāti Porou, we haka, like, it is a huge mixture of cheek. And because that's how our ancestors portrayed it as well, and it was used in many different occasions like that. As I say that, I just picture my dad, you know, he was a real cheeky performer as well. So yeah, definitely seen as, in that way. And there's been a lot of different haka written that way too lately, that put messages across in that way.
The Wire.
That was Hamuera Kotuku Maika from Te Kura Māori o Ngā Tapuwai. We'll be back after this song.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
Yes, it is Worry Week. And just before that, you heard Sight Beyond the Line by Hex, which is nice to have a little song in there. But now I have Leah Garcia-Purvis in studio and also Dong Doris just yelping in the back. But we are talking about smoking 2025 this week on The Wire, essentially the idea that the government wants us to be smoke-free by 2025, and, you know, The Wire can look at that in whichever way they wish. So we've heard a couple of different things the past couple of days. What have we got today, Leah?
So I had a look at how much it actually costs to quit. And cold turkey is a viable option for few. However, considering smoking is an addiction, a lot of people need some intervention. Nicotine patches are generally the first port of call for those wanting to quit. And that's $32 for 7, which is 16-hour patches. So there's 16 hours per patch.
Do you know sort of what amount of nicotine is in there, or does that...
Oh, I'm really, yeah, I just have all the facts up here, but I will have a look.
That's right.
Yeah.
But so somebody that puts on a patch for 16 hours,
yep.
So and that you get 7 in a pack, that's basically a week, right?
That's a week,
so that's
yep.
$30 for a week.
Yeah, that's right.
And
I think that's about this. I think the dosage is about the same for the gum as well. So whenever you feel like a cigarette, you can just chew a piece of gum. As far as I know,
okay.
I haven't had them. I've only had the patches, but yeah,
all good.
Yeah. So
keep going.
Yeah. So there's like the patches, and then there's also the prescription of SSRIs, which some doctors prescribe when you get addicted to something. And the first port of call for that is like fluoxetine.
And that's to lessen.
That's to lessen like the actual craving for it. So, among other things, it actually craves that it actually it subsides your cravings for anything that might be setting it off. And those take usually up to 2 appointments to prescribe, which is if depending on what doctor you go to, it's $40 to $60 per visit, which is. And then you got to pay for the prescription on top of that, which is depending on what pharmacy you go to, it might be $3, it might be $4, something like that. That's funded too. So even if you're not from New Zealand and you don't have a residency, it costs a little bit more. And then on top of that, usually doctors recommend that you do some sort of counselling. And if that's not referred via the ADHB, usually that's about $150 per session, and they recommend that you do one at least every 2 weeks. So that's $150 per 1 hour session privately. If you don't get referred, it takes 3 months to refer at the least to be referred and called back by the mental health service.
Wow.
Yeah. So like if you accumulate all that, that's almost like $3,500 over 6 months. So that's
a lot of money.
Yeah.
And a big commitment.
Yeah.
While you're also
huge.
Dealing with the mental aspects
yeah.
of giving up something.
Yeah, exactly. And so 5% of those smokers still relapse. And a study done in 2014 showed that, I couldn't find any New Zealand stats, but in the UK they lost over $14 billion a year in productivity through like 10-minute smoke breaks. So that's a cost as well that you have to kind of, I mean, nobody should ever be, classified as revenue or productivity through money. So in New Zealand, the rates of being exposed to secondhand smoke were higher for children living in socioeconomically deprived areas, and it's even higher for Māori. So when you look at everything, is it really accessible? Is quitting really accessible? Like, everybody looks at it as like, well, we've got all the facts and figures and we know it's bad, but can we actually do it? And then you look at the social things, like you might have a lot of mates that smoke, and it's all the you know, the environment type stuff. So is it really accessible? Are we doing enough to, you know, because $4 for a family living on, say, $500 a week and they've got three kids, it's not, you know, it might not be viable. It's just easier to keep smoking, regardless of, you know, the perceived facts.
So this is a good look at the kind of context of what people are facing in terms of choosing to quit to smoke. There's this whole other side of things. I mean, I didn't know any of this, actually, and I didn't realise that. Obviously, yes, like you said, you can go cold turkey, but that's very difficult without certain supports.
Extremely difficult.
And often we don't talk about putting money into these other aspects or creating more support in that side of things. Thank you, Leah. You're going to keep talking about this in a little bit. We're just going to go to a break and we'll be back with Lisa's report.
Cool. It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
The Auckland Arts Festival brings you the Festival Playground at Silo Park, a resplendent new space for music, art, food and family fun. March 24th at Festival Playground, A Tribe Called Red, Tiki Tane and Rhea Hall, an unmissable triple bill. Canadian DJ collective A Tribe Called Red blending hip-hop, traditional powwow drumming and vocals with edgy electronica. Dub legend Tiki Tane and free-thinking and unapologetic blazing musical force Rhea Hall. Auckland Arts Festival's Festival Playground, March 8th to the 25th. For information, go to aucklandfestival.co.nz.
こちらは 95BFM オーディブルワールドです。
The Audible World, World Music Treats and Bizarro Ethnomusicological Finds with Andrew McLeod and guests.
なんか人放りでなめ、FM ビコントンドルなめ。
Let your ears bathe in all the splendor of the planet's oral delights. The Audible World, every Sunday night from 9 to 11 p.m.
Ascoltate il mondo audibile, Radio 95 BFM.
The Wire.
This week on Wire Worry Week, we focus on smoke-free 2025, the goal set by the government to make Aotearoa New Zealand hell on earth for smokers in 7 years. Yesterday, Leonard walked you through the history of smoking in New Zealand, and today I want to carry on this work with an analysis of campaign advertisements throughout the years. So as explained yesterday, smoking used to not only be widespread, but also, believe it or not, cool in New Zealand. In the first half of the 20th century, the kind of ads you could hear or watch on television sounded a little like this.
I can't seem to find a cigarette I can stay with. This one tastes harsh.
That's easy to fix. Try one of my cools.
Long side.
Mm-hmm. I think you'll like them.
Come up to the cool taste.
Taste extra coolness every time you smoke.
Tobacco manufacturers were targeting various people, for instance housewives, which led to a significant increase in smoking in the female population and therefore prevalence of smoking-related premature deaths. These ads also helped shape the stereotypical and somewhat dangerous definition of what a man is supposed to be. Such advertising was usually broadcasted on television or played at the movies before the film, having a wide reach, hence greatly contributing to the peak in smoking in the early 1960s. By then, half of New Zealand men and a third of New Zealand women were smokers. An increase of scientific research on the link between tobacco use and health issues throughout the 1960s, 70s, and particularly 1980s led to a growing concern for smokers, but also their social circles. Passive smoking was acknowledged, smoke-free environments spreaded, and tobacco advertisement was slowly phased out. Cigarettes advertising was banned from radio and televisions as early as 1963, it disappeared from cinemas and billboards in 1971, and finally was banned from print media in 1990, thanks to the Smoke-Free Environment Act. In the meantime, health promotion and smoke-free lobbying emerged and slowly conquered. And even though New Zealand has one of the lowest rate of cigarette consumption in the OECD countries, and that rate keeps going down, it is still not enough for these advocacy groups. It's hard to find clips online of television campaigns dating back further than 2005, so I'll focus on those I managed to find, which were created by Quitline and the Health Promotion Agency. The first one that I could dig up dates back to 2006, and to be honest, it's a rather lame ad. It's got a very movie-like aesthetic, but I would not be surprised if it did not have any impact.
I wish there was no gravity. And our feet knew no boundaries. I wish it rained gold. And we lived in a smoke-free world. But wishes never come true. Or do they?
However, this ad is a good example, I believe, of what does not work to convince people to stop smoking. And I also believe anti-smoking groups have understood that, because later campaigns became more relatable and started targeting specifically afflicted communities. Anti-smoking campaigns can be grouped in various categories. You have the willingly shocking ones. They're very graphic and they don't shy away from showing the damage occurring in your body. Let's have a listen to these Quitline's ads from 2015 from a campaign called Every Cigarette Is Doing You Damage.
Every cigarette is doing you damage. The cigarette smoke you breathe in thickens your blood and damages your arteries. In time, the damaged arteries become narrowed, reducing the flow of blood to your heart. This can cause a heart attack. Every cigarette is doing you damage.
Obviously, you can't see them, but they are visually gruesome and are pretty much the vocal equivalent of the pictures you can find on cigarette packets today. They heavily draw on people's fear of dying or simply not being healthy. Now, it's hard to tell how effective this is as a smoker. As a smoker myself, I am fully aware of the risk for my health, thanks to this shocking imagery. However, that knowledge has not made me quit yet, and I tend to just hide the picture or try not to look at it for too long when I grab a smoke out of my pack. Anti-smoking groups might have understood that this was not sufficient. They now usually combine the medical aspect with a more personal, relatable story, like the one of Adrian Pilkington, who died from oral cancer shortly after shooting a campaign for Quitline. Relatability seems to be at the heart of campaigns. Families are usually used to show that smoking is a selfish vice that might take you from the family that loves you. There is this 2013 Quitline campaign.
I'm a single mother, and I realised that if I died because of my smoking, who would be there for them? That was the moment I knew I had to quit.
I've been smoking for 30 years, and one day it hit me. How much it's cost me and my whānau. What a waste.
We buried our mum and sister years before their time, all because they couldn't give up the smokes. That's when I decided I'm going to quit smoking.
Alongside these general ads, campaigners now try to specifically target the population most at risk. Māori and Pacifica communities proportionally smoke more than any other communities in New Zealand. They are extensively featured in ads, some of them even being broadcasted in both English and Māori.
In our home, we do thank yous. We do respect. We do adventure. We do hugs and kisses. We do family. And we are smoke-free. Are you ready to go smoke-free? World Smoke-Free Day. It's all about whānau.
Another group particularly affected by smoking is young people aged 15 to 24, or even younger. Peer pressure plays a major part in New Zealand youth picking up smoking, sometimes from as young as 10 years old. Campaigners have used different strategies to change the minds of impressionable kids. At first, they relied heavily on celebrities to endorse a smoke-free message. Groups used people perceived as cool, role models to a lot of children and teenagers, and got them to say that smoking sucks.
I don't smoke, I don't like smoke, and I don't like being around it. My whare and waka are ōrahi kore because I choose to have it that way.
Smoking is kaka. I don't like it when people smoke around me.
Kids not knowing about smokes or or anything.
What do you mean?
A smoke-free Aotearoa? It'll be awesome. Smoking, not our future.
Then ads tried to blame parents, showing they were setting a bad example for their children and therefore being potentially instrumental in the kids picking up smoking at a young age.
All three of them were smoking?
No, not my son. I told him never to touch any smokes.
So?
So? He'd never disrespect me. Marlo! Was it your idea to smoke? Why?
It's because he wants to be like you.
But the health promotion agency apparently reached great results with their campaign Stop Before You Start, which launched in 2014. Its ads were definitely targeted at young adults, and the quirky sense of humour seems to have hit a nerve with young Kiwis.
I first started seeing him socially, out with friends and that. He was always around and we'd get together. He was always at parties and hanging out with my flatmates, and now he even comes to work with me. I never dreamed I'd end up with him, but here I am. He says he might give me cancer one day. Yeah. Yep, we're in it for life. Come on.
To be honest, when I first met him, I thought he was a bit of a jerk. He was always getting in my face. He even hooked up with a couple of girls I fancied. But after a while, we started spending more time together. Pretty soon, we're always together. He's holding me back on the rugby field a bit. And there's a chance that he might kill me. But what can I do? I'm hooked.
I used to see him occasionally, you know, at the pub with friends or workmates. I only really saw him when I was drinking, and once or twice I snuck out of work to see him. I was a bit down when Isaac dumped me, but this guy. He stops me from buying shoes and stuff, but honestly, I'd rather spend my money on him. I haven't told my mum. She'd freak because he killed her sister.
So are these ads really efficient? Well, a study led by the University of Christchurch found that 45% of the people who had watched the ads regretted smoking, and a third said that they stopped smoking around others, and even 28% apparently stopped altogether, which is quite significant. More importantly, the study found that this ad targeting young people had impact on adults. And then there's been a couple other studies that show that certain specific ads have had effect in specific areas of New Zealand, like one about smoking in the car with children and one with young Māori people in the country. So that's pretty encouraging.
Lisa, you're a smoker yourself.
Yes.
Are you intending on quitting?
Yes. When I started, I told myself that I didn't want to be an adult smoker. So I decided 25 was kind of the limit. Back then, 25 seemed like me being a dinosaur.
How old are you now?
I'm 24.
Okay, not long to go.
It's actually coming in 6 months, so I'm not feeling too good about this.
Do you have any kind of ways of going about it, do you think?
Well, all the people that I hang out with pretty much are smokers, so we've kind of all decided to stop at the same time, which I believe will be very helpful, because if only one of us stopped, then it would make it that much
social
harder.
Social support, yeah.
Yeah, social support, definitely.
Leah, do you want to add anything?
I totally agree with the social support thing. Like, my best friend lives up north, like 2 hours, and I don't see her that often, but she smokes like a chimney. So whenever I'm with her, I finish off a packet, like, no problem. And it's hard to, like, not do it either. So I'm kind of like, well, if she, yeah.
Okay, we are running out of time.
Yeah.
But Cheers Peter has texted in, which is an exciting moment of the day. And he actually raises the point that I was kind of interested in terms of talking about smoking finishing at 2025.
Yeah.
We have a caller on the line, actually. Let's just go there. Hi, caller.
Caller, let's keep it simple. Kiss a non-smoker. Taste the difference.
All right. Thanks, caller. Bye. Cheers, Peter said that tell the government to butt out with their social engineering. How we choose to live is none of their business. Just smoke and take responsibility for it. Cheers, Peter. More freedom, less government. Now, this is the point that I was kind of raising, right? Is where do we draw the line with the government getting to say what is allowed and what isn't allowed.
I think the line that's being drawn is that if taxpayers, I guess, are going to have to pay for medical bills indirectly, I guess, for people who suffer from complications due to smoking, then, you know, should we not work more on prevention so that people don't have to pay for that? I think that's the main argument, is that one, is that, you know, if you're going to subsidize health, then maybe you shouldn't.
All right.
I think it's their semi-right to ban sort of smoking in public areas because, you know, but in that sense, you kind of stigmatize a lot of people who can't give up. Like I said, you know, it might not be affordable or doable for a lot of people to just give up on the spot. And it becomes, and addiction is a psychological thing as well. So essentially, I think you're kind of stigmatizing mental illness again.
Brilliant. Yeah. All right, we are running out of time, so let's leave it there.
Worry Week on The Wire. That was The Wire.
To very quickly thank everybody that was on the show today, Alan Blackman, Hamrida, and our very great producers, Lisa and Leah. Bridge is up next. You're on 95 BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.